Well, Acts 17. Acts 17 has been, it's been a model chapter in the modern missionary movement because of the way that Paul retells the Christian story for a new audience. Paul doesn't speak about Jesus the same way to everyone. To a Jew seeped in Jewish literature and Jewish culture, he speaks one way. To a Greek seeped in Greek culture and Greek literature, he speaks another way. He reshapes the gospel story for a new context. He retells the gospel story for each new context. If we could just go to the map, please, Mike. Just have a look at the map here. Top left-hand corner, we've got Thessalonica, and then just, it's difficult to see Thessalonica, but the top left-hand corner, and then just south of that, the next red dot is Berea. And then down, further down to Athens, on the peak of, just down there in Greece. That's the journey that Paul makes in Acts chapter 17. And it's in Athens that Paul does the speech to the Areopagus. Do you remember the speech to the unknown God? That's what Acts chapter 17 is the most famous for. That occurs in Athens, and that's where we're going to spend most of our time today. And the impact on Acts chapter 17 for the modern missionary movement is very, very interesting. You see, back in the 1800s, most of the time, most cross-cultural missionaries didn't pay much attention to culture and the context that they're in. In fact, the usual expectation was that indigenous people, that nationals, would come to learn the English language or the Portuguese language. And the expectation was often that to come to Christ genuinely, they would have to leave their native culture. They would have to even be removed from the people that they knew. James Hudson Taylor was a man that God used powerfully. James Hudson Taylor died in 1905, and he went to China aged just 22. He lived to about 80. When he first went to Shanghai, he went as a doctor, and he traveled around Shanghai on preaching tours extensively, and he would preach the gospel, but despite his medical expertise, he didn't make much of an impact. The Spirit of God didn't use him in people's lives from his observation. And then he realized one day he had to make a switch. And so this young 22, 23-year-old adopted the national dress, as you can see. And he grew a pigtail called a queue, and he shaved his forehead according to the custom. And he learned three different Chinese dialects. And as hundreds of people came to Christ, they built churches in the traditional Chinese way. And people back at home in England heard about this. And hundreds of people, literally hundreds of new young missionaries, came to China. And James Hudson Taylor taught them this new way of doing things. And he started an organization actually called China Inland Mission, CIM. And that's still one of the biggest missionary organizations at work in Asia. It's called OMF, Overseas Missionary Fellowship now. And Hudson Taylor started this in this way. It's good to know that it's almost unthinkable now for cross-cultural missionaries not to work this way, as Hudson Taylor did in other countries. Look, the word that's been used for this way of working is contextualization. To contextualize means to live as Christians and to speak God's words in a way that is appropriate for the new context, not for the context that you've come from. Contextualization doesn't mean watering down the gospel. Contextualization doesn't mean compromising. It means speaking the truth about Jesus and living in a way that's appropriate to the new context. And it would be unthinkable for cross-cultural missionaries going from Canada not to contextualize. An example of contextualization in Canada today has been the question of when speaking the gospel to Islamic people in Canada, Australia, the US, what do we call God? This has been a question of contextualization. Do you refer to God speaking to an Islamic person as Allah? Well, it's a comfortable word that they'll understand. That's an advantage. A negative might be that Allah comes laden with a lot of freight. It comes laden with the Islamic worldview. So that's a negative. Or perhaps talking to an Islamic person, do we call God God? On the positive side, it doesn't come laden with an Islamic worldview. But on the negative side, it comes laden with a Western worldview and all the sexual immorality and consumerism that Muslim people rightly, generally abhor. And over the last 20 years, this has been hotly debated among missionaries and in mission journals. And the consensus has more or less been that in talking to an Islamic person, it's most helpful to refer to God as Allah. Contextualization. It's interesting to think, as we come into Acts 17, how do we contextualize the gospel for secularist Westerners, our friends and workmates here in Canada? How to contextualize the gospel to secularists in Canada? If we can grab the next quote, John Carroll is not a Christian, but he's an expert on Christianity and the world. And this is what he writes. The waning of Christianity as practiced in the West is easy to explain. The waning, he's saying, the reduction is easy to explain. The Christian churches have comprehensively failed, watch this, in their one central task, to retell their foundation story in a way that might speak to the times. That's John Carroll from La Trobe University, Melbourne, Australia. We've failed in our one central task, he says, to retell our foundational story in a way that might speak to the times. In other words, what John Carroll is saying is this, that we're doing in Canada and Australia what would be unthinkable in cross-cultural mission. We haven't contextualized. So with this question, how do we contextualize the gospel to Vancouver in 2011, we get into Acts 17. How does Paul contextualize? Well, let's kick off. We start in Thessalonica, and you'll see here in verse 4 that in Thessalonica, Paul is speaking to Jews. That's very important. In verse 4, it says he's speaking to Jews and God-fearers, and God-fearers are Gentiles who believe in the God of the Old Testament but haven't been circumcised. And this is what happens in verse 2, if you'll follow along from Acts 17. Do please have your eyes on Acts 17, verse 2. As his custom was, Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Christ, he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and not a few prominent women. When speaking to Jews, Paul's arguing from the Old Testament Scriptures. That's our first point. Old Testament Scriptures is the playing ground. That's the playing field. He argues from the Old Testament. There's persecution in Thessalonica, and so he travels south to Berea. The Bereans respond more positively to the gospel. There's persecution there as well, so he travels further south to Athens. We don't have time to look further at Thessalonica and Berea. We're going to move on to Athens now, to the Greeks. We're in Athens now. Friends, in Athens, we're in the intellectual and cultural capital of the Roman Empire. The Romans had the power, but the Greeks had the personality and the brains. You know that Athens is the home of Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, the great philosophers. And you know that Greece too is the intellectual home of humanism, the celebration of humanity. The Olympic Games, for example, started in Athens, right? The celebration of the human body. It's the home of philosophy. And it's the home of great architecture too. This is the Parthenon. The Parthenon was built 500 years before Paul stood there. And the Parthenon, of course, is a temple to Athena, the god, patron god of Athens. And Athena has been worshipped here for 500 years, the goddess of the arts and the crafts. How's Paul going to contextualize in Athens? Well, let's have a look. Let's read verse 17. So Paul reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks. Now watch this. As well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. In Athens, a lot of people spent their time discussing the latest ideas. And here in verse 17, Paul joins them in the marketplace, discussing and preaching about Jesus. It's kind of like an ancient cafe culture, I suppose. And Paul joins them and gets amongst it. That's how Paul's contextualizing. And now we see, actually, that there is some mockery going on from the philosophers to Paul. Have a look at verse 18. It says, a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? And that word babbler there, interestingly, is a word for, it could also mean bird. And they're picturing Paul as a little, like a little sparrow, a little hummingbird, a sparrow picking seeds off the ground, picking cheap little ideas. He's a pseudo-intellectual, just picking cheap little ideas and sprouting them out. What's this babbler trying to say? And then they take Paul, and it's not a friendly word, they take him in verse 19. They bring him to the Areopagus. And the Areopagus meets here usually on Mars Hill. Here's Mars Hill in modern times. Mars Hill rises above Athens. And here on the hill, the Areopagus, which is the council of Jewish elites, they meet. And they take Paul before this council with legal authority, and they could make some trouble for Paul. What's Paul going to say? How's he going to contextualize the gospel before the Areopagus? Now comes the speech to the unknown God. And it's brilliant, to be honest. But to understand its brilliance, we have to understand Paul's audience. So let's summarize Paul's audience here. I know you need like the sight of Superman to see this. First of all, Paul speaking to the Epicurean philosophers. Now the Epicureans, they focused on the material world. They were an ancient scientist. They observed the world meticulously. They were the first group to think of small particles, which they called atoms, which they said an atom was the smallest unit, the smallest particle. And they scoffed at the popular idolatry, the popular worship of idols. They scoffed at that. They focused on the material world. Second, we've got the Stoic philosophers, the second group of philosophers. You know, but we know the word Stoic here in Canada. A Stoic is someone, you know, if someone had a relative die and they had a stiff upper lip, you would say, well, they're being very Stoic about it. And that word Stoic would mean that they're not being emotional, that they're being a bit matter-of-fact. And that is because of, we get that word from the Stoic philosophers. The Stoic philosophers mocked emotion. You couldn't grieve. That was a sign of thorough weakness. And this is because of their belief in the unity of the universe. Everything is one. And that meant that the individual kind of was just a part of the universe. So that if there is a tragedy, so to speak, it's just an event in the life of the universe. The individual is dissolved. Is just a part of that, so then everything can be rationalized and nothing needs to be felt. And then thirdly, we have the popular idol worship, the worship of many gods, demonology, spells, incantations, all of that stuff. How's Paul contextualize to this group? Well, let's get stuck into it. Paul starts off by finding common ground. And this is very important to note. He finds common ground. He really starts with a compliment. Have a look in verse 22. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." You're very religious. So he starts off with a compliment. He starts off with common ground. That's a good idea, isn't it, to start off with a compliment. It's interesting to note there that you are very religious can have a double meaning. That it can also mean in the Greek, you are very superstitious. So while he's getting the pagan idol worshippers on side, he's also scoring some points possibly with the Epicureans and the Stoics. Because he could be saying, depending on who's listening, I see that you're very superstitious. So he's finding common ground, starting with a compliment perhaps, and now he continues. Verse 23, "For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you." Well, here is an ancient altar that says to an unknown God. And it's dated 100 years before Paul, and it's kept in Rome, in the Palatine Museum there. And these were very common in Paul's day. And actually, it's not surprising that altars to an unknown were very common because of the nature of idol worship, which is this. If you're making a sacrifice, you make a sacrifice to an idol on an altar like this because you want to win the God's favor and you want to placate the God's anger. So, for example, if you were a craftsperson in Athens, if you were a leather worker and sales weren't going so well, you would go to the Parthenon, you would sacrifice at an altar like this to Athena, the god of craftspersons, in the hope that sales would get better. And we need to understand this. This is very important, that the gods depended on these sacrifices. Sacrifices were food for the god, literally. This is what they ate. So you can understand why the god would get angry if you didn't offer sacrifices. So why? But this is the problem. What if there was a God we don't know about? What if there's a God we haven't heard about, we haven't been told about? And what if they're angry because they're going hungry? And so we build an altar to an unknown God. And then Paul capitalizes on this. He finds the gap in their knowledge. And he says, "Now what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you." It's brilliant. And I suppose in terms of strategy, he's doing this. He's finding common ground. And then he's finding the gap and he's filling it. Well, Paul goes on now to say this. God doesn't need you, Athenians. He doesn't need you. He's independent. He doesn't need you to have his evening supper. Have a look at verse 24. "The Lord, the God who made the world and everything in it, is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all people life and breath and everything else." God doesn't need you, Athenians. And can you see here how he's winning points with the Epicureans? The pagan worship is silly. He's winning points with the Epicureans. God doesn't need you. But he's also pushing the Epicureans to take an extra step. Because he's as much as saying to the Epicureans, "You're rejecting, your God that you're rejecting is too small, Epicureans. You're rejecting a small God. But I'm proclaiming to you a big God. A God who gives life and breath to every person. God gives you your every breath, Epicureans." That's a very good point, that God doesn't need us. Actually, I heard a story that illustrates this nicely. A friend of mine back in Australia, that God doesn't need us. He was a child at the time, and he was at church, and sitting there in the pews, and during some long sermon, he drifted off and started looking at one of the plaques on the side of this old church wall. And it was a plaque of a man who had died, who'd passed away. And it said on the plaque, "The Lord hath need of him." The Lord hath need of him. And even as a young boy, my friend thought to himself, that can't be right. Does the Lord really hath need of him? So he went home and he talked to his mum and dad about it. And they opened up the Bible. And they found the verse. It's in Luke chapter 19, actually. They found the verse. And this is what he read out as a young child. Jesus said, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a donkey tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie the donkey and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying the donkey?' tell him, 'The Lord hath need of it.'" It's a donkey that Jesus needed. Not a very flattering way to speak about your departed relative. And you'd be a donkey to think that the Lord hath need of you. Because God doesn't. In Reformed theology, we call it the doctrine of the independence of God, that he doesn't hath need of us. He doesn't need us for his evening supper. Or the doctrine of the transcendence of God, that God is great and he doesn't hath need of us at all, though he does delight in us when we come to him. In fact, now Paul flips it and he says, actually, we need God. And here in verse 26, from verse 26 he says, from one man God made every nation of men, people, so they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. We have need of God. Absolutely, is Paul's point. Well, I just want to take an aside and note here. Paul's fascinating third strategy. Paul is quoting their poets twice here. For in him we live and move and have our being, is Greek poetry, and we are his offspring. And it's just worth noting, because that is another strategy that's well worth keeping in mind as we're talking to our friends. I mean, we've got strategy one, to find common ground. We've got strategy two, taking their thinking to the next step. But then strategy three, to quote from the worldview of the person we're speaking to. I do honestly try and look hard at song lyrics and quotes from books that I can use in conversations with my friends. That's worth doing. Paul says, we need God. God doesn't need us. And here, he's kind of running with the Stoics for a bit. He's saying there is a unity between God and humankind. In him we live and move and have our being. There is a unity, unlike what the Epicureans think. But then he pushes the Stoics one step further and he makes a distinction between the creator and the creature. Nonetheless, God made us, and so we need him. Well, here is an interesting question for me. How hard will Paul push? I mean, he's contextualizing for all he's worth and doing very well at it. He's being winsome, but how hard will he push? Will he, for example, speak about the judgment of God? I heard recently someone say that the judgment of God is an embarrassment of Christianity. And to be honest, the judgment of God was just as embarrassing in the first century in Athens. How hard will he push? Will he speak about the judgment of God? Well, the answer is twofold. First, yes, he will and he does. But second, this is interesting, he shows how this difficult doctrine of the judgment of God makes sense of the world. And I think that's very, very significant for us as we're coming into the world as Christians. He shows how it makes sense. And the way Paul does it here in Acts 17 is, he's just spoken about how God has loved the world to life. In him we live and move and have our being. And then he speaks about the patience of God and then judgment. If you'll have a look at verse 29, God says, therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think of the divine being, we should not think that divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all people by raising him from the dead. So Paul has said, God's loved the world to life. God has been patient. But God has set a day. The day is sure, and Christ will come and judge. And that has worked for many people in Paul's first century audience. He's contextualized well. But you might be thinking, if in a university today I was to say that, people would still laugh. Okay, so we have to contextualize for 2011. Actually, for myself recently, I was speaking to a young man over coffee at university, an artist, who did a lot of reading, and he said to me, I could never accept a God who is angry. I could never accept a God who judges. So I said to him, I've recently just finished a book by a Canadian refugee, Nega Maslekia. And Maslekia comes from Ethiopia. And in this book, towards the end of the book, he expressed his anger at Western stinginess toward third world poverty. I mean, he described how Ethiopian cities had been decimated to rubble by war. And the West comes in and sells baby powder to Ethiopian mums. And Nega Maslekia is angry at this. And I said to my friend, if Nega Maslekia has a right to be angry, and I take it he does, then doesn't God have a right to be angry? In fact, don't we want a God who is angry at first world selfishness? In fact, shouldn't God be very angry at first world selfishness, even if his God angrier than Nega Maslekia? And if there isn't that a good thing, because now evil won't triumph? And since we know that humankind has a habit for millennia of selfishness, isn't it true that unless there's a God like this, there's ultimately no hope for the world? So don't we need a God who takes moral culpability, evil, selfishness seriously? Isn't that exactly what the world needs? Well, our relationship is ongoing. Fortunately, let's just kind of bring this home for ourselves. Let's just go back to John Carroll's quote from La Trobe University in Melbourne. We want to ask, how are we going to contextualize Canada 2011? John Carroll said, "The waning of Christianity as practiced in the West is easy to explain. The Christian churches have comprehensively failed in their one central task, to resell their foundational story in a way that might speak to the times." I am fascinated here that he has the perception to know that this is our one central task. To retell the story is our one central task, to contextualize. And in the light of Acts 17, isn't he right? And this is a non-Christian who's saying it. And I named this talk after this quote. I called the talk Retelling Our Story. So how do we do it in Canada 2011? I think it's helpful to think of three spheres: as individuals speaking to one-on-one, as a local church in our community, and then as a wider church to global issues. So first of all, as individuals. If we could grab the next slide. The first sphere, as individuals. I think you and I just have to prayerfully grow in our ability to hear who we're talking to have big ears, to know the individual that we're talking to, and to listen really well, and to contextualize in the individual conversation. I think that's critical. I've got a mate who is just great at this. Back in Australia, his name is Tim, and he's a prison chaplain. And he's sitting down every week with people who are before the courts. He was speaking to a guy, we'll call him David. David is charged with drug importation. The trial is commencing, and so David seeks counselling and prayer with my mate Tim. And darkness was the word that was on David's mind. He recognised the darkness that had characterised his life over the years. And so through Tim, he began to seek the light of God. That's one of the ways John's Gospel speaks, isn't it? The light of God and his word to empower and liberate him from bondage to the various addictions that have held him captive to a life of darkness. I'm kind of quoting Tim here. Here's another bloke, Samuel, another inmate. Grievous bodily harm with intent to murder. Sentenced to 5 years. He's wrestling with conviction, with his conviction from the courts and with guilt, and he's concerned about his crime defining him as a person and defining his future. So Tim counseled him to see that the sum of all his parts is tied not to his guilty verdict, but to the powerful scriptural truth of being created in the image of God. So he wants to explore this, what it means in terms of the sum of all his parts being found made new and established in the living God. Isn't that fantastic? Light and dark, image of God. How will you present the gospel to your friend or your relatives? It'll start with a whole lot, probably hours, of listening, won't it? Number two. Second sphere is the local church. A local church has got to know its streets and suburbs and schools and communities. We've got to know it. And distinctively and in particular ways minister to our area. And you know what? The knowledge is right here in this room. We know our community. Mothers here know what mothers need. Teachers know what teachers need. Business people know what business people need. And I have said to Aaron maybe 10 times, I'm so impressed with the entrepreneurial ability of this community here at Willoughby. And I am so interested to see what initiatives God has for this church family. And what initiatives and what dreams God is going to put on your heart individually to change this area for Christ. And maybe it'll be something that this whole church has to get behind. And if it is, maybe you'd write a letter. Oh, I'd love it, please, to write a letter to council or an email to council. And so the council can chew on this with you and pray on this with you and throw it around so that we can have 20 great entrepreneurial ideas and change this area for Christ. Third, the wider church. Contextualizing in 2011 means that the wider church, our church included, has got to be speaking and acting into the pressing needs of today. And three, I think perhaps the three greatest pressing needs, certainly three of the most pressing needs, are third world poverty, second and third world poverty, global warming, and asylum seekers, immigration. They're three of the most pressing issues today. The church has got to have a voice, and the church has got to be living prophetically. Now, I think it's true that the CRWRC is outstanding in this regard, at providing leadership for the Christian Reformed denomination. What's the church got to look like in Canada in 2011? Let's pray. Jesus, we believe in you, that you're Lord of this world. And we believe that that truth makes sense of reality. That every truth in Scripture, in the end, if seen rightly, is not an embarrassment, but is life-giving to this world. And Lord, this is complex stuff for us. We want to know our world. We want to know deeply our friends. We want to know you and your heart for this world in a prophetic and deep way. Lord, would you be with us intimately on this journey and show us the shape of the gospel, how the gospel speaks life into Canada in 2011 and into the world in 2011, and how the gospel speaks life to the person that we're going to be encountering this week. Show us this, Lord. Help us think deeply about this. Fill us with your Spirit so that we're gracious and tenacious and have big ears. Empower our church, Lord, with your Spirit so that we might, in life, word, and deed, be reflecting in the most powerful, powerful, attractive, beautifying ways your restorative rule. Come, Holy Spirit. We are willing servants, and we need your empowerment, your enlivening, and your beautifying of our lives. Send us, Lord. Amen.